You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show.
All right. Happy Tuesday, Canada. How you doing? Hope everybody's doing all right. Upstream, that's where we're going. Every day is a paddle upstream, paddle against the variants, paddle against the crap news, paddle against news that the U.S. is going to suspend Johnson & Johnson. We don't even have ours. We're expected to get our first doses of Johnson & Johnson this week. Concern about blood clots, not a big concern. Happened in women about aged 18 to 48, and they've already distributed close to 8 million of those, and they've had one death, so it's not nothing, but the risks do not outweigh the reward. And the reward is we're getting way more deaths from the variants. Still, I wish they didn't have this. So there's the bad news. And then you've got politicians who are making decisions for us. This is their job. Now, I'm going to go on a little rant today, and we've got a great show. We're going to get your thoughts on the airline bailout, close to $6 billion for Air Canada. I mean, we are now in the Oprah moment of governance. You get a billion. 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 And that's even before the April 19th federal budget. Now, we need to protect our airlines, and we're going to talk about this. But there's a couple things in there that bruise my apple. They are going to look, Canada just spent $500 million buying shares, equity. We bought 6% of Air Canada. So you should look around you. You're now the owner of 6% of Air Canada. You're going to save up to 38,000 jobs. That's real, because that's what they employ. And the terms are you're lending them another $5.5 billion in low interest loans that they say they're going to pay back. Cross your fingers on that. I hope they do. This is not a crazy situation. Germany and France have done the same thing with their airlines. You need an airline. And in return, Air Canada is going to fly in those routes that they canceled. So, you know, it's a big country. People need an airline. I get that. Can employ people. I get that. Pay back the loans. I get that. I like the equity stake. I like that. You know what the thing that kind of sticks in my craw? One of the things is you can't, we're going to cap executive pay at $1 million. Well, that was a, must have been a tough one, eh? We're going to cap executive pay at $1 million a year, but that's including all compensation. That's including dividends and stock options and salary. Must be a tough time to be making $1 million a year, eh, folks? That must have been a tough negotiation. Now, to be fair, stop wherever you're listening. If you're listening on your smart speaker or in your car or in your home office, or maybe you're an essential worker at your office, let's just pause for a second and think, what does the CEO of Air Canada actually normally make? There's just the CEO. Lots of executives make lots of money. You want to guess? $13.5 million. That's what. Now, to be fair, last year, the CEO took a pay cut down to $5.5 million a year, just $5.5 million a year. So this $1 million a year cap, folks, is really austerity for those folks. This is really tough times. They're going to make $1 million a year capped. Now, we called the PMO this morning, the Prime Minister's office, to check how long is that going to be in effect for? They say till the loans are paid back. Okay. We'll see about that. They're going to pay back the ticket. By the way, just in case you want to know how the merry-go-round of money works, the Canadian government, with your money, is giving low-interest loans to Air Canada of $5.5 billion. Those loans will be used to pay you back if you are an Air Canada ticket holder to the tune of $2.5 billion. So the government gives the money to Air Canada on a loan basis. Air Canada now will pay you back that money for the tickets they've been holding this whole time. And so the circle of money goes around and around and around. It's just, we're just washing it with a very low interest rate. Now, again, I think we got to save these airlines. This is an industry that's been hurt. But that means we have to like it. That means you have to like it. When you break your arm and you need surgery and a cast, you need it. Doesn't mean you have to like it. It's just what you need. This is bitter medicine, but it is. But here's the thing about politicians, I try to call balls and strikes. You know, yesterday I called out Chrystia Freeland because I think on the verge, you know, she's about to have this massive budget, and she had the audacity at the Liberal convention to actually declare that the pandemic is a political opportunity. This is going to haunt her. I've said this before, a political opportunity. You know, the only opportunity the pandemic is to end the pandemic. I know that because of the pandemic, there will be new policies, but a politician calling something that has killed over 23,000 Canadians, locked us up, put us in deficit, mental health crisis, a political opportunity like this is one of the most tone-deaf and insulting remarks I've heard in the entire pandemic. Listen.
COVID has created a window of political opportunity and maybe an epiphany on the importance of
never say that. So here's my 3 minutes of political rules. One, don't call COVID a political opportunity for one of your policies. It's not about you. It's about us. That's one thing politicians have to remember. Not about you. Don't complain that this is really hard, that opening and closing and we know it's hard, but we voted you in for that job. Leaders that are saying, oh, you think this is easy? No. Do you think we want to hear you complain about how tough your job is? Have we heard nurses complain and doctors complain and grocery store clerks complain and truckers complain and small business? You don't get to complain. You're getting a salary and you were voted in because you wanted the job. Please don't complain that this is a really hard job in the pandemic. Is it? Of course it is, but you wanted it. You cannot climb up Mount Everest and say, oh my God, the air is so thin up here. The wind is saying this is so tough. You wanted that climb. You reached the top, stop. And then don't come on and use and gaslight the people with false statements to cover your political hide. Let's go back to rule number one. It's about us, not you. For example, last night on CTV's Power Play, after the school closures, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute, the in-school learning was closed, I asked the Conservative MPP, David Piccini, who was on the show. I said, look, it's odd. Like your government, your own Ontario Finance Minister, Stephen Lecce, literally sent parents like me a letter saying that we are going to be on... my kids will be back in school after the April break. And my kids are on the April break now. They're upstairs doing their driving course right now, both of them, which is hilarious. I'll get to that in a minute. And here's what he said to me. He goes, no, let me correct you. The letter never said that the schools would be open. Listen to what he said.
That letter that the minister sent out was to talk to the investments that the government's making to support them when schools do return. So I understand that people get that letter and they see, you know, here are the investments that the province of Ontario is making to ensure safe schools, and then they see this. But I think you can sympathize that I think it's important for the minister to communicate those measures to instill confidence in parents and to talk about the dramatic investments, but while also the need to act very decisively, as we've done.
Okay, Stephen Lecce, the education minister, not the finance minister, actually sent a letter saying schools would be open. And now Mr. Piccini, who's in that government, is saying, you know, no, the letter was actually about investments. I can understand how people might get that letter and see that, but can you understand? Let me read you the letter, because I'm a parent. It said, during the provincial emergency break and the provincial stay-at-home order, all publicly funded and private elementary and secondary schools will remain open for in-person learning with strict health and safety measures in place. Yeah, can you understand why we said that? Because that's what he said. Then you're correcting me and gaslighting, saying, no, it was really about the investments. Stop. Here, it's not about you. It's not a political opportunity, and tell us the truth. We're not saying you can't change your mind, but when you do, tell us the truth. Now, I want to take a break, and I want to get at something. Is the future of online learning permanent? That's next.
Hey.
As your world changes, we adapt to get your answers. Now more with Evan Solomon.
Welcome back to the show. Okay, so schools are a big thing. My two kids are on what's called an April break right now. So they're upstairs. I'm in the basement, as you know. Basement dweller, cave dweller. And God, if you all saw how lame my setup is, I keep seeing my colleagues on radio with their fancy setups. You know, they're at these really nice desks. And for whatever reason, I had this special line put in my basement. So I'm the idiot in this. I don't even have a desk. It's just so sad. I've been doing this for a year. I thought it would be temporary. Anyway, I have a very pathetic setup, but it was pretty funny. My chair's not very comfortable. It's not even a desk. It's cold in the winter. It's the basement. All right. Anyway, so my kids are upstairs and they're doing their driving test right now. You know their driver's ed? My son just turned 16 and my daughter's a year older. So they're figuring this out, right? And this is what they're doing. And now they're not going to school in school learning after this week because like every other kid in Ontario, and I know in Quebec, you got staggered starts. And if you're listening in BC, I know Bonnie Henry says schools, this is the crazy thing. And I'll get to this in a second. She seems to think that it's good to go to schools, even though now BC has gone from the best to one of the worst places because they have this wicked variant. But she seems to think being at school is good. This is why everyone's so screwed up. So, and my kids are kind of disappointed. They're like, wait, I thought we were going to school after. I said, no, you know, the Ontario government keeps flip-flopping. I don't care that they changed their mind. I wish they wouldn't do it every 24 hours. I wish when they did it, they just admitted. I wish when they'd actually listen to the modeling forecast instead of pretending that modeling doesn't exist. Remember, it was February 11th that the Ontario chief of the science advisory table, Dr. Steiny Brown, predicted there was going to be a disaster. Ontario woke up and, you know, opened up and now there's a disaster. Now they're like, we never saw this coming. Right. Okay. Like, you know, when the doctor says, if you don't exercise and you smoke and you drink too much, you're going to get liver cancer or you're going to get lung cancer. And then you get it. You're like, I didn't see it coming. Yes. Yeah, they did. They actually saw it coming. But schools are a really odd thing, right? Because there's a lot of debate about should you have the kids in schools and should you not. And, you know, in the first wave, I was all about keeping the kids in schools and vaccinating the teachers, right? Because there's economic benefit to that. Keep the teachers safe. The kids aren't getting it. The mortality rates and the sickness rates were low. I get it. Now the third wave, it's a whole different ballgame. It's much more infectious. Younger people are getting it. We definitely now need to do the teachers. And it's scary. But I'm a little confused about this because on one hand, Ontario's closing it. And then you see Dr. Bonnie Henry in BC saying that schools have nothing to do. She's not following the Ontario model because she says, listen to this, schools are not at risk.
When we see increased transmission in the community, it's when children were not in school. And with the structured time and the important structure that school gives to families and communities is really important, and it's a less risky environment.
Okay, so I just want you to know, I'm playing that because you must be as confused as me. If you're in BC, apparently the virus does not infect kids in the school, so they're going to keep them open. If you're in Ontario, they got to shut down the school. Now, what do I always say? Confusion breeds distrust. That's why you're seeing protests. That's why you're seeing people who are so fed up with this. You know, people are partying in parks, and then you've got mayors, like where I live, the mayor of Ottawa is really upset that people had a party in a park, which is not great, but there's so little evidence that being outdoors spreads the virus. They're actually thinking about, you know, is there going to be a curfew like in Quebec and on parks? People need parks. People need to be outside. You should be careful, like Dr. Bogosh told us yesterday. Be careful in parks. It's okay. Be careful in parks. Keep your social distance. Parks aren't a free-for-all. But Dr. Bogosh was on this program yesterday and saying, you know what we should do? We should let people drink in parks for the next 3 months because they need something. My producer, Hannah, you know, she and her boyfriend live in an apartment, no balcony. Park is their outdoor space. You close that at 8 o'clock when it's still light out. What are people in their 20s going to do? They're going to go crazy. The government has to be super careful stealing civil liberties from people. You have to do it to protect people, but you have to explain it well, and you have to do it in a way that people don't rebel. Parks are not the enemy. And the battleground over schools is real. But I just want to quickly ask you, and I wonder if even I have time. Reg Cohen, who's a smart columnist, he writes in the Toronto Star, said, you know what this is really about? And I don't know if he's right in terms of the hidden agenda. I don't try to figure out hidden agendas. I try to talk about real agendas. And this has been their real agenda in Ontario and other places, which is they want to promote online learning. And do you want to see online learning becoming a permanent option? And I'm just going to, and you can text me at 71010. I don't even know if I have time for a 1-855-633-1010 call. 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. I know the pandemic is going to give a lot of evidence. Well, we should make online learning permanent. Well, it's cheaper. They really wanted to do this before the pandemic in Ontario and other provinces. It's part of the curriculum. Two or three courses or four courses will be online learning. We talked about this on this radio show. Who's paying for that? Is it privatized? I could tell you as a parent where I'm at, I know that online learning has been really helpful and the teachers have done a lot. But is it really nearly as good as in-class learning? My answer is no. One of my kids really doesn't like it. One of my kids likes it more, but it's they're missing socialization, they're missing lots of teacher FaceTime, they're missing all the benefits of gathering. You don't want people to be sitting alone in front of a computer screen like students for hours on end. I am praying. Well, I think the option of online learning is going to be there. Hey, politicians, don't for a second think that you can save money on our education system and use this pandemic as some trial test for mass online learning. I don't want it. I know there's going to be a place. Mitch is in Toronto. Mitch, go for it.
Hi, Aaron. How are you today?
No, Mitch, I'm doing it. I love having the program on. I'm a lucky person. What's up?
I don't think it should be online learning at all. I feel that the kids need the social aspect in life to interact with other kids. You know, I've seen my own kid as well. He's 6 years old, and I've seen his mental health decline since the beginning of all this.
Yeah, and Mitch, I'm sure as a dad, it's hard to watch our kid. Like, think about where we were in school, right? You're playing. There's activities between classes, recess, after school. There's clubs. There's socializing. There's all that learning. None of that's being done online. None of it.
No, none of it, and, you know, it doesn't really set them up for anything future, you know. There's no extra, there's no sports anymore. We can't get them into anything right now, and it's heartbreaking, really.
And you, I agree, Mitch. I totally agree with you. And if online learning becomes permanent, imagine how difficult it will be to fund sports and clubs and getting teachers in the school. Imagine how difficult it's going to be just to socialize. Like, learning the best, we want all we care about as a society, should be giving our kids the skills they need to make a better life than we have. Isn't that what a parent wants? You should have a better opportunity to fulfill your dreams, and your quality of life should go up generation from generation. Isn't that right? Well,
I'm with you, and if they start doing all this online learning, quality of life is going to go down because now you need one parent to sit at home all the time, and you know now it takes two parents in life to make ends meet, really.
Yeah, Mitch, I agree. Thanks for the call. And Mitch and I are in agreement on this. Look, is there a place for online learning? Yeah. Should it be permanent? No. Should this be a mass experiment to make it permanent? No. Evan, I think virtual learning should be a fundamental tool of education. There are students who could probably excel. Students are sometimes not happy in the classroom. There should be additional counseling. Yeah, some people thrive. I get it. And I said there's a place for it. It shouldn't be permanent. And I'm telling you, for the amount of money we spend on education and teachers and the work teachers do in class learning. Now, if you're in remote or you're sick, we have great systems to compensate. But those are compensations. Those should not be replacements. All right, I'm going to take a break. When we come back, a $6 billion bailout for Air Canada. We're going to bust it down, what it all means for you. We'll be right back.
finding answers to all your questions. You're listening to The Evan Solomon Show.
Hello, fellow owners of Air Canada. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, you bought yourself 6% of an airline. You now own $500 million of shares of stock in Air Canada. That's right. And then you also have loaned on a low interest about $5.5 billion to Air Canada because they've seen a 70% decline in their business. And through something called the Large Employer Emergency Finance Facility, which is a new program. That's right. You now have loaned them $5.9 billion. $1.5 billion of that is going to give you money back for your tickets. So for those of you who have been sitting around waiting to actually get a refund on those tickets, this package was all contingent upon Air Canada paying them back. And Air Canada said, well, we can't pay them back. So how about this? You guys lend us $1.5 billion and we'll take that money on a low interest loan. And then we'll actually use that money that you're giving us to pay back the very people that are actually paying you to give us the money. So this is called the merry-go-round of money that goes round and round. Now, there's other issues. They're paying Air Canada in order for Air Canada to reestablish routes to certain parts of the country that had been grounded. That's really important. I'm not going to be snide about that. Air Canada employs 38,000 people at its peak. There's less than 15,000 of them working right now. Yeah, that's a lot of jobs in this country. That's real too. So they get it. And then this is the real tough one though, folks. They're going to make those executives, those Air Canada executives, they're going to cap their salary. This is probably a really tough, because this is where you really understand the word austerity, guys. They're going to cap the salaries, including stock options, at just $1 million. That's going to be tough. Because the CEO of Air Canada is used to $13 million a year. $13 million a year. That's more like it, right? So now they're going to have to live on $1 million a year. And apparently, according to the Prime Minister's office, they won't get bonused out with stock options until the rest of the loans are repaid. But we'll see about that. But look, is this a good deal? It certainly saves jobs. Will other airlines line up? Like, will WestJet line up for this? This is, by the way, Air Canada has already been using the salary top-up, right? They've been using the existing programs to help pay their employees to the tune of $500 million. So this is expensive. And I want to, and here's Chrystia Freeland, the finance minister, announcing the deal last night.
I'm announcing that the Government of Canada will step in to support Air Canada, its nearly 15,000 active employees, and its customers. This support will be in the form of loans that Air Canada will repay to the federal government.
So they will repay it. Now, remember, that hasn't always happened. We did the same thing with the auto companies. Not all of them repaid. Some did. But, and she said 15,000 employees. That is active employees. You know, Air Canada can employ more than double that. So is this a good deal? Jerry Dias is the president of Unifor. That's the largest private sector union in the country. He's going to weigh in on this first. Jerry, great to have you on the program. What do you make of this deal and how it's rolled out?
Look, I think it's a heck of a deal. I think it's a good deal by the government. I think it's a good deal for Air Canada. And frankly, I think it's a good deal for us. What does everybody get out of it? First of all, the government's preoccupation had to be about protecting the industry. You can't talk about a build back better. You can't talk about, what the economy is going to look like after the pandemic without a strong airline industry. So they took care of that. Number two, they knew it would be suicide if, in fact, they gave one nickel while consumers were owed $1.4 billion. So you can check that box. We have to make sure you open up 17 regional routes, which they did, because you can't have a country as vast as ours where people can't get connected. So you can check that box. They wanted to make sure there's jobs. So you're right. There's 15,000 people working out of 35,000. That becomes the new floor and people will have to be rehired with the 17 routes. And also there's jobs created in the aerospace industry with Air Canada committing to buy 40 737 MAXs, which is going to keep my members working in Winnipeg. And of course, the 33 A220s, the old C series, which will employ people in Mirabel and the surrounding areas. So you can check a lot of boxes. And by the way, I do like the 6% ownership of Air Canada.
Okay, it's Peter Jerry Das from Unifor. Some unions that you know, like the Air Canada part of the Canadian Union of Public Employees, which represents like 10,000 flight attendants, they were furious of it because they say 7,500 members have no income support. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, that's why they're served. That's why we're talking about the wage subsidies. But look, the industry is flat. You've got Air Canada right now is probably running at about 35%, if that. We're in a pandemic. Nobody's flying. So do I wish all my members were recalled? Of course I do. Is it possible? Probably not. Is it realistic? Probably not. So for me, I'm looking for a foundation. I'm looking for somewhere to start. And the place to start is by ensuring they're going to survive. Air Canada has blown through over $4 billion in the last year. So that's not exactly the ticket to long-term survival. So am I critical over the fact that more people I've recalled? I wish they were, but I understand the dilemma that people are facing. Look, if people aren't flying, people aren't working. It's not complicated.
Yeah, speaking of Jerry Dice, it's true. I should say this, folks. Canada's not doing anything that many, you know, France is doing almost an identical thing. They took a big chunk of Air France. Germany took a big chunk, a bigger chunk than we're taking of Air Canada, of Lufthansa. So all these airlines are getting smoked. How long will it take to pay back these loans, Jerry? Because a lot of Canadians, you know, this is all, oh, it's a loan. You know, this is a government that bought a pipeline that was supposed to sell it, and they've never been able to do that. You remember in the auto bailout, some auto companies did pay back, yep. Some didn't. So can Canadians trust that this is going to happen before we get the next story about some CEO who's going to say, finally, okay, well, I did get, you know, $8 million this year.
Look, they got $1.4 billion at 1.2% to repay the consumers. They've got another 5 years, another $2.5 billion, anywhere between 1.5% and 2.2%. The numbers rise dramatically from an interest rate point of view over 6 years. So my guess is Air Canada never hits that number. So my guess is this is about 5 years max, and will they pay back? Of course they're going to pay it back. I don't think they have much of a choice here. So, look, I think it's a good deal for Air Canada. I think it's a good deal for us. I think it's a good deal for workers. So,
About WestJet? Are they going to take it? Because WestJet said, you know, like, I'm just wondering, is every other airline going to start lining up? Because WestJet saying, look, we've taken the wage subsidy, but we're not going to take these loans, maybe. But I think they will. They're negotiating.
Of course they're going to take the loans. I mean, look, people are not going to take the loans under the LEAF program, because under LEAF it started at 5%. And it escalated up to 8%, 9%, 10%, depending on the amount of time. You could have got a better interest rate from a loan shark than the LEAF program. So I would expect that's what took so long for Air Canada, was to make sure that they negotiated themselves some interest rates that they could live with. So I think, you know, it gets complicated. People were arguing what took so long, including me, by the way. But I've been around the horn a little bit when it comes to negotiations, and anybody can carve a deal quickly, but whether or not it's a good deal or not is a subject for another day.
Well, it's a deal, and I'll tell you what, whatever you think, folks, this country is big, and we need an airline to survive. Jerry Dias from Unifor, great to have you on the program, as always, sir. Thank you.
Always my pleasure, Adam. Have a great day. Take care.
Okay, so that's Jerry, and he's got their workers. This is a lot of jobs, but this is $5.9 billion. Let me ask you, because I want your thoughts. Do you think it's a good idea for the federal government to give this kind of aid package to Air Canada and other airlines? I just want your thoughts on that. Remember, you're going to get your refund finally, 13 months later. 1-855-633-1010. What do you make of these bailouts? 1-855, or loans, however you want to describe them. 1-855-633-1010 or 7-1010. Should you just let Air Canada fail? I don't think that's an option. 1-855-633-1010 or 7-1010. I really want to get your thoughts on that next on the Evan Solomon Show. Stay with us.
As the story changes, we react. This is the Evan Solomon Show.
All right, welcome back to the show. I want to get your thoughts. You know, anytime the government decides to make loans for almost $6 billion, don't you think we should maybe talk about it? I'm such a stickler for your billions. Like anytime the government says, you know, we have just decided to offer Air Canada $5.9 billion in low interest loans, plus $500 million of that, just a half a billion, is we're going to buy equity in it and we're going to use part of that money to pay back tickets and restore 17 different routes. And we're going to cap the executive salary at $1 million, hashtag austerity. They usually make 13 million. Don't you think we should get a chance to weigh in on that? I don't know. Government's using $6 billion for one company. I don't know about you. I'm kind of intrigued to, maybe it's me. Maybe it's just me. Maybe I just like hearing from people and I don't know, it's your tax dollars. So, you know, 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. Again, I could make arguments that we got to save the airline. I think we could. Do I like the equity stake in it? I do. I've always said, take equity. Is 6% equity enough? Low interest loans, good. Are they repayable? I like that. I like that. I don't know what the payback schedule is. I know there's 5 years on some of those. It's a long time. I've seen this movie before, but okay. Capping the exec bonuses. $1 million seems like a lot, but okay. Michael in Ottawa, what do you think? Do you think it was a good idea for the federal government to give this aid package / bailout, call it what you want, to Air Canada?
Hey, Evan, I do. It's necessary. We're a G7 country. We need our airline industry. Also, as Daya said, the vast geography needs to be considered of Canada. What we get angry about is with these bailouts, we're going back to the 2008 housing and loan crisis in America. At the end of the day, the CEOs continue to get rich. They continue to get rich. And why don't they contribute some of their millions, if not billions, these executives, to the industry that is hurting? That's what makes the average citizen angry. These CEOs,
Michael,
keep getting
Michael,
rich.
Michael, don't you understand anything? Stay on the line. Don't you understand, Michael? You know what they're contributing? Instead of getting $13 million, they're only going to get $1 million. Do you have a violin that you can join me and we could play a duet of sympathy? Should we do that?
Okay. You're making me trip, but I've made my point. And
I know what you mean. No, listen, I get it. I get it. Listen, Mike, I'll be serious for a second. I mean, only in the world where you're getting paid $13 million is $1 million like a tough bargain. It's comical, right? Like, because it's a crazy amount of money. And I totally get what you're saying. The fact is, CEOs of these big companies make so much money that $1 million is considered a big contribution. I'm kind of with you, though. I think when the taxpayer is paying $6 billion or close to it, even in loans, that's going to stick in people's craw no matter what. And I appreciate the call, Michael. I also agree with you that we need an airline industry. Let me see what Anthony says. He's in the hammer. Anthony, welcome to the program. What's up?
I just hate when anybody plays with the free market economy. I disagree. I think that if any business goes broke, there always will be people around who will pick up the pieces and operate in the void. I disagree also with capping the salaries of the executive, because then you just get lower quality executives. They need to be able to operate in a free market. But under these circumstances, the only thing I would want is equity in the company. What's the point of giving them low interest loans? You want to have equity.
Go ahead. Go for it.
Justin is just trying to buy the next election with our money. This is all part of, I'll spend as much money as I can, make myself look good, and get reelected with a majority.
Anthony, listen, let me respond, and thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Drive safe, brother. We are getting some equity, $500 million of equity. So you do own, you're now the proud owner of 6% of Air Canada. Maybe you want more. I believe in an equity deal. So you can share in the upside, not just the downside of these deals. Do I believe in that companies should be allowed to die? I don't think you can let a national airline die in a country like Canada. I think there would be such a massive economic fallout, not just the 38,000 jobs, Anthony, but yeah, would people pick up the pieces? Maybe, but airlines are, it's a complicated business. There's not a single country that has let their, like Germany's not letting Lufthansa die. France is not letting it die. The Americans are bailing out these industries and they give subsidies. I got to tell you, the economic consequences of that, to make that moral hazard point, which I know you're talking about, I think is too big. That's why the deal has to be not let it die, but pay back, make money. And that's equity. Doug, what's up? I think you're listening on the iHeart app in New York City. How's it going?
Good. I'm actually listening to Alexa, and I'm originally from Montreal, so I love to listen to CJAD, and just started tuning in, found you by surprise. It's great. Love the show.
Thanks, Doug.
I wanted to say, on January the 2nd, I think, or 1st, actually, January the 1st, 2018, does that date ring a bell to you? I was on a flight with you, speaking of airlines. And I began to freak out because one of our engines died, and you were the only calm person on the plane. I'm not even kidding you. You were like cool as a cucumber, and it's always impressed me.
Remember. Recall? Okay, Doug, I'm going to tell Doug. Oh, well, good to meet you again. Okay, so I'm going to tell folks this. It was Christmas. I was on the plane with my wife and my two kids. Doug, it was a Porter flight. We were going to New York, right?
After New Year's.
And one of our engines flamed out, and it was a bit of an emergency situation, and we had to make an emergency landing. Remember that?
And I remember the endless emergency landing. It took forever to get that plane down. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah, it was a kind of a scary situation. I remember there's a couple. Yeah, it was a nerve-wracking moment for some people. And so, that's so funny. Yeah, I remember. Yeah. I mean, I think part of my reason is, A, I had my kids there and my wife, but also I have been flying, you know, part of my job for 20 years was to fly every week all over the world in different, like literally crazy places, you know, war zones, crazy places. And I just, you know, I'd flown with the military. And I think that helped me just because, you know, you can fly on one engine, and I was just hoping that they were going to land.
Yeah, you could picture dying in Kandahar, but not over Oshawa or something. You know,
yeah,
I agree.
Yeah.
So I see that $1 million cap is the offer, I guess. And, you know, it seems like it makes sense to me. You know, United Airlines, you talk about larger salaries buying better CEOs. I tend to disagree. If you look at what United is saying now, their next push is going to be to have their pilots be, racially, you know, equalized and gender equalized, which I find totally bonkers. You want the best pilots, right? You don't go and say, hey, where did the pilot come from? What skin tone does my pilot have? You know? So I just discount the notion that a lot of money buys you a good CEO. That's the first thing.
And I got about 10 seconds here real quick.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, Doug, first of all, good to see you again. And I hope you're safe. Stay safe in this. And thanks for listening on the iHeart app and Alexa there. And Doug, nice to meet Doug again. We met on a bad flight, speaking of airlines. Just a couple things on that. Like, you can have diversity and you can have quality. I don't think it's one or the other. Number two, look, I know CEOs get paid a lot of money. $1 million still is a lot of money. In what world is $1 million salary a year not a lot of money? Who wouldn't work for that? Boy, do I have a lot of text. I'm going to read some more text when we come back. I got to take a very short break. Hang in there. We got a great show coming up.
You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show.
Welcome back to the program, everybody. I just want to say I got a flood of texts on the corporate bailout / loan aid package to Air Canada. Everything from corporate welfare needs to go to decent deal for Canada. This country needs to have an airline. I also like the cap on exec compensation. Good job. To no, I don't think these bailouts are a good idea. Why do we need Air Canada anyway? I got it all. To we needed more equity. So great comments. Great comments. I really appreciate it. One of the things that this entire pandemic has exposed is the need for governments to be clear about what they want. This is a pandemic that has killed 23,000 people. Everyone's looking at the United States. Oh my God, they're doing so much better than Canada on the vaccine. True. But then again, they did let close to 550,000 Americans die. The UK is doing better than us on the vaccine. They did significantly worse than us per capita on mortality rates. Way more people died. They screwed up. So this is a deadly virus. But right now we saw riots in Montreal over curfews. We're seeing pushback against restrictions as the deadly third wave happens. And in Alberta, it came to a head when 16, now 17 members of the premier's own party signed a letter, and they said, we need you to ease up the restrictions, ease up the restrictions. And Jason Kenney's pushed back, especially in the fact that the province recorded 1,136 new cases, 679 cases of the variant strain. There's close to 15,000 active COVID cases. Like the province is, you know, not in great shape right now. And there are doctors wanting more restrictions. But one of the MLAs who called for Jason Kenney to ease up the restrictions is Drew Barnes. He's the Alberta MLA for Cypress Medicine Hat, and Drew's on the line now. Mr. Barnes, good to have you on the program.
Good morning, Evan. Nice to talk to you.
So, Drew, you know the stats. I carry on my program every night Dr. Hinshaw from Alberta. I take it live, that press conference, every single night. So I know the case is there. You've got even your premier, who has not been known to want restrictions, needs restrictions. You've seen how fast the new variant has overwhelmed Ontario, which opened up. BC used to be the great case. Now it's a terrible case. Is it responsible to write a letter questioning the need for restrictions in the midst of a vicious third wave as ICU beds are filling up, Mr. Barnes?
Yeah, absolutely. It's responsible. I'm grateful that I'm one of 87 MLAs paid by Albertans to speak on their behalf. And Evan, there's lots of different things being said right now. In Cypress Medicine Hat, we have a mental health, a physical health, an economic and a spiritual crisis as bad as the COVID crisis. Every day there's that impacts, you know, become, they bubble to the top. From self-harm to overdoses, and the economic crisis. I mean, I just got off the phone with one of my constituents who just had to lay off 8 people, and he is very worried about the ramifications of that. Secondly, Evan, Alberta...
Mr. Barnes, I just want to... You said it's every bit as bad as COVID. First of all, I don't know what data you have on that. You know, we've lost in Canada 23,000 people to COVID. And suicide, which is tragic, I've happened to have lost friends to suicide, but we lose on average about 4,100 people to suicide. The idea, look, I'm not saying there's no mental health crisis. I get it. I have kids. I see people going through it. I'm not trying to underestimate it. But the idea that you're comparing, saying the mental health crisis is as bad as the COVID crisis, there's no stats to back that up, sir. There's just not.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's as challenging for sure. And, you know, then Medicine Hat is an example. You know, to a lot of my constituents, it's frustrating that Alberta spends $25 billion a year on health care, and Alberta Health Services hasn't clearly shown how they've done the surge capacity to handle the non-essential or the emergency surgeries. Again, Alberta's big. We're bigger than most European countries. What me and my colleagues have been asking for is a regional approach. You know, for long times in big parts of Alberta, we've had zero cases or very few cases in areas hundreds of miles by hundreds of miles with lots of room and hospital capacity while, Evan, we're dealing with these other issues. Plus, the vaccinations are starting to happen. I think all of our long-term care residents are vaccinated now. Our healthcare workers that want to be, a lot of them, we're close to having all of them vaccinated as well. So, you know, we're at a time where we owe it to every single Albertan to look at every single impact of the COVID regulations and lockdowns and restrictions And I don't really care which one's worse. Let's help all of Albertans as much as we can, and let's recognize that we have lots of challenges right now, more than just COVID.
But COVID, look, we have a lot of challenges, but it's called triage. You know, when you go to a hospital, the people who have the worst, most urgent care get first up. There's lots of issues, Mr. Barnes, and I'm speaking to Drew Barnes, Alberta MLA, who signed one of these letters. But have you seen, and I'm going to play you a clip, have you seen how quickly these new variants have overwhelmed the systems in Ontario? It today does not mean you're not going to have it tomorrow. Like, here's an Alberta doctor who have spoken up saying we need actually further restrictions. Listen to this.
What we're recommending today is an immediate lockdown or circuit breaker and essentially a stay-at-home order. So we are asking that people only leave their homes for essential services. They only have contact with members of their own household.
And then you got Dr. Day. There's lots. Here's an ICU doctor in your own province about the number of people going up because of the new deadly variant. Listen to this.
In the past week on call in our ICU, we cared for those aged 20 to 60 years, all with severe COVID. Not one with a pre-existing health problem. Some made it out of the ICU after a period of time on the ventilator. Some did not and unfortunately died.
So I guess my question is, I listen, no one loves these restrictions, but undermining your own premier at this time when the variants are coming in, do you think that's a response? I'll just ask you again, do you think it's responsible to go against the advice of the doctors?
Then I don't see it as undermining. Two other doctors came out yesterday morning talking about how the non-pharmaceutical interventions weren't working in their fulsome and the harms of the lockdowns. Many of my constituents call me and say, hey, look at Texas. They were at about the same vaccination rate when they opened up, and now their number of cases are plummeting. There are people really starving, Evan, for information, for knowing which way is best to protect themselves and their family. Alberta, we can be the beacon of freedom and prosperity, and we have a lot of self-reliant people that care deeply about our compromised and our seniors and want to make sure they're protected and want to have a full debate about it and want to know that.
But sir, I get it, but hold on. I got to just challenge you. You've just said that you're not sure that the non-medical interventions work. I don't have time to get into the studies, but you're saying lockdowns and restrictions may not actually work. Sir, they do work. Texas is a different example. They have significantly higher rates of vaccination. Look at Michigan. Michigan has higher rates of vaccination. They opened up. Their rates are going up again. Every single medical officer of health, including in your own province, your medical officer of health, your premier, and in every other province and in every state has said restrictions have actually mitigated the dangers. I've interviewed Dr. Fauci on this. You're now coming on a national radio program and saying restrictions don't actually have an impact on COVID and things like social distancing. Sir, respectfully, that is radically irresponsible because you're flying in the face of what every single medical officer of health is saying. Why do you think you have an authority to do that?
Well, I'll say this. I think the argument is that non-pharmaceutical interventions may have consequences as grave as what they're preventing. Now, of course, I believe in social distancing, mask wearing, and washing your hands, but it's all these other consequences. The consequences around the mental health, the spiritual health, and the physical health. And, again...
Okay, Mr. Barnes, I got 20 seconds here. Do you want to stick around? I'll keep you for another round, and I'll hear callers. I'm delighted to... Sorry, I don't mean to cut you off. I just have these breaks. But I'll keep you, and we can keep this conversation going, just to be fair to it. I got to take a break, but I hope you stick around, Mr. Barnes, on the Evan Solomon Show. I'm happy to have this.
Talking to the newsmakers every day. The conversation continues with Evan Solomon.
Welcome back to the program, everybody. Look, there's a lot of confusion, and I understand it. There's a lot of frustration. We all feel it. But the question is, are the restrictions necessary? Now 17 members of the United Conservative Party caucus, that's Jason Kenney's party in Alberta, have actually signed a letter and wrote a letter. Originally it was 16, now they're 17. And they said, look, we don't support all these restrictions. We think it's time not to. One of those MLAs is the Cypress Medicine Hat MLA, Drew Barnes, and he's been on the program with me. And then I'll get your thoughts on the restrictions, 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. And Mr. Barnes, I know you only have a couple minutes, but thanks for staying with me. And look, do I believe that every place, every location is the same? No. We don't know how we define lockdowns or restrictions. There's lots of different definitions. I appreciate that. But the contention is that these restrictions in the wake of the third wave are not necessary and should be eased. My contention is that according to almost every medical officer of health, including yours in Alberta, that's the wrong data. I know you cited Texas. I just wanted to make sure I got these data right, Mr. Barnes. I know you said Texas is a good comparison. Almost 50,000 people have died from COVID-19 in Texas. 50,000. They have a population of about 6 million less people than Canada. We've lost 23 million. So they've lost more than twice the people of Canada in Texas. Why would you hold up Texas as an example when their death rate is twice that of Canada and significantly higher than Alberta? Like, it seems you don't want to be like Texas.
Well, yeah, absolutely we don't. I mean, of course, you know, all the Albertans I talk to, every Albertan cares about each other. They care about our vulnerable. They care about our long-term care. It's one of the reasons, though, Evan, we have to have the discussion. A lot of medical experts, a lot of emergency experts are saying if we'd have locked our long-term care down in a different way with quarantine, with rapid blood testing, with vaccinations quicker, we could have done better to save more lives in that case. So let's look at that instead. And let's look at now of the effects of the lockdown in other ways. Let's look at the fact that many of our regions, you know, don't have overloading of our hospitals and our ICUs and that kind of thing. Well, people are suffering in so many other ways. You know, I'm grateful that I'm one of 87 MLAs that can speak up in Alberta. And it's my job to present different ideas. It's my job to present different experts.
But is it your job if you're not a doc? Like, this is a pandemic. This is not, it's your job. I get it. It's your job. And I know people are frustrated, but it is your job, and, you know, on government and size of government. And I get civil liberties. But in the middle of a pandemic, when you are running against your medical officer of health, your own elected premier, who you're in the same party as, in the midst of a pandemic that is now, you know, overwhelming. I get you in medicine, how it might not be bad today, but it wasn't bad in BC 3 weeks ago. Now it's terrible. Like, do you think that doesn't give you pause at this moment to say, maybe I'm a little over my skis here when I'm pushing back against restrictions against the entire medical establishment?
No, again, I think it's my job to speak up, to reflect the anxiety, the lack of hope that 50,000 people in Cypress Medicine Hat many of them are telling me that they're experiencing. It's my job to present different ideas to get us all through the COVID pandemic as best we can. And I'm grateful that I have the chance to do that, and I'm going to continue to do that. And we're in a democracy where a full, robust discussion is always going to make us better and stronger. And let's do that.
Would you violate the restrictions? I know Jason Kenney said if you violated any of the restrictions, he'll boot you from caucus. Mm-hmm.
I absolutely would not. I've gone further, and I've encouraged my constituents and any Albertans that reach out to me to follow all the rules and the restrictions, and that I will continue to advocate for what they think the changes should be. You know, all the inconsistencies, Evan, are one of the problems. The churches are the easiest one to explain. You can have a funeral on a Friday with 20, then a wedding on Saturday with 10, and if 15% capacity is 150 on Sunday, you can have 150 on Sunday. People are saying to me they want to follow the rules. They don't know what the rules are. Why are the inconsistencies? Why can you go to a big box store where you're in a huge lineup, or you can't go to a mom-and-pop store that's safe? You know, these are the discussions that we have to have.
But we're having those. Okay, Drew Barnes, my pushback on that is I 100% agree we need a discussion about confusing mixed messages, but let's not compare apples and oranges. Confusing messages does not necessarily lead to, okay, because there's a confusing message, let's ease back the restrictions that the premier that I I actually am in the same party, has put on and that the medical officer of health is saying. But I agree with you. Confusion doesn't help. I think this doesn't help. I'll be candid. But listen, the reason Drew Barnes is on the program is there's a legitimate debate. People need to hear these voices. We'll never shy away from new opinions. Drew Barnes, I always appreciate having you on the program. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Evan. Have a good one.
You too. So look, I don't mind. Look, at you know me. I'll have anybody on the show and I'll debate them. Do I think it's responsible for 17 MLAs in Alberta who are members of Jason Kenney's party to actually come out against the restrictions? I think it's crazy because I think the lesson we've learned from COVID is that this third wave moves quickly. Do I think comparing the dangers of the mental health and the suicide to COVID? Listen, we all understand the mental health stress and the suicides. We've seen it, but it's not, unfortunately, it's not killing as many people as COVID. COVID is killing more people. The stats are overwhelming. 23,000 versus 4,000. That's called triage. Three, for an elected member to come on national radio and say, you know, non-medical interventions, in other words, non-vaccines, don't really work, is just, there's no data. Again, I come back to what I began with this in this program. It's gaslighting. Social distancing obviously works. That's non-medical. Washing your hands obviously works. Now, there's lots of different forms of restrictions. It doesn't have to be the Quebec model, the Ontario model, the Alberta model. But clearly, when you, as we've seen all over the world, lockdowns in some form, restrictions in some form, they work to mitigate the spread of the virus. So for MLA say, well, we just want to have a discussion. That is not a discussion in the middle of an emergency. When your house is burning, someone, you don't say, well, listen, is water the best way? I think there's a lot of non-water ways to put out a fire. What if we drop sand on your house? Do you have sand? No. But let's put out the fire. Then we can talk about, in the future, if foam or sand is better. When your house is burning, use the water. And the house is on fire. This is not a debate club. This is a life and death emergency. Do we all want businesses back? You better believe it. Do we all want to get the government off our backs in terms of restrictions on our movement? And you better believe it. Everybody feels the same way about that. But as an elected official, you're a leader. Sometimes, I know this may sound strange, sometimes you've got to lead. If some of your constituents are really frustrated, I agree, but when you are counteracting the chief medical officer of health in your province, your own premier, it's not like Jason Kenney's known for his restrictions. He was late on everything. You are undermining confidence at a dangerous time. You should be leading and protecting people. The concept of freedom is core to our democracy, but limits on freedom for protection is called the reasonable limits clause in the Constitution. It is, I'm going to say it, and you know me, I like to have people like Drew Barnes on. I don't mind hearing it. I think it's reckless and irresponsible to write that letter to try to undermine the restrictions. Have a discussion. That's what your legislatures are for. Raise these issues. We'll raise them on this radio show. But you're a leader. You're not a doctor. And you're telling people restrictions actually aren't effective. It's not true. This is very consequential, dangerous stuff. All right. I know I was going to get... Drew went long. I'm getting, tons of stuff. And believe me, he's not wrong that the confusing messages are adding up. That's fair. That doesn't mean the answer is loosening up right now. All right, when we come back, we got news that you don't want to miss on the police.
When important decisions are made, we report. Here's Evan Solomon.
Welcome back to the program, everybody. It is rare it is rare that Canada deals with a mass murder situation, a serial killer. But that's what happened in Toronto, we know, into the Bruce MacArthur serial killing in the gay village in Toronto, quote unquote, the LGBTQ communities. And there was a report released today prepared by the retired Ontario Court of Appeal Judge Gloria Epstein that looked into how the Toronto police investigated the crimes and the victims of Bruce MacArthur, including something called Project Houston, which probed into the first three victims of MacArthur. Now, someone who wrote a book about it, we've interviewed him about the book. He wrote a book called Missing from the Village, Justin Ling. He's a freelance investigative journalist. He spent years researching this and following this. He joins us now to get because we want to get the latest on this report that was prepared by the judge. Justin, good to have you back on the program.
Hey, good afternoon, Evan.
Tell us what this is just released. I honestly, I've been on the radio most of the time. I haven't even had a chance to look at this thing. You have, what is in this, report that was just released?
It's pretty significant. I mean, it clocks in at about 1200 pages. There's 150 recommendations in here, and most of those recommendations have a bunch of sub recommendations to it. So this is a pretty significant report, probably one of the most impactful and wide-reaching reports into Canadian policing since the OPAL Commission published its findings almost two decades ago now. That, of course, looking into Robert Picton and his crimes. But this report offers a really wide look at sort of two things. One of them is the relationship between the queer community and marginalized populations overall, and the Toronto Police Service. And that's a relationship that the report says is one of underservice yet over-policing. The second piece is on how the Toronto Police Service handles missing persons cases more broadly. And it finds a whole bunch of issues there, from how missing persons cases are first reported, to how they're triaged, to how they're cataloged, how they're investigated. The report actually finds a randomness with how many missing persons cases are handled. Some of them get a full rundown, a proper, thorough investigation. And frankly, it seems like some of them just sort of get cast aside and forgotten about. And the report finds there does seem to be a systemic problem there, one of race, sexuality, gender identity, housing precarity, Indigenous status, so on and so forth. So it's a pretty, shocking look at how, even in Canada's largest city, basic policing still, fails to meet the mark in many respects, especially if you're in a particularly vulnerable population.
Yeah, speaking of Justin Ling, who wrote a book about that, about the Bruce MacArthur serial killings. He was convicted of killing eight men between 2010 and 2017. I'm just looking, as this report has just landed, this massive report into this, the headlines, just interesting. New York Times just minutes ago, as you and I are on air, anti-gay bias hindered Toronto police as serial killer roamed. That's the New York Times right now. So does this highlight, you said, it's not just an anti-gay bias, anti-marginalized community, anti-person of color, but that's the headline. Was there clearer, and this is what your book was about, an anti-gay bias in the police?
It's tough. I think, frankly, the report largely says there was not an issue of inherent anti-gay bias by individual officer. But what there was, sorry, something in my throat here, but what there was a general systemic bias problem that sort of cut across the entire Toronto Police Service. It was a bias that led to them being unable to see connections in front of them, that led to them failing to ask the right people, ask the right questions, to go to the right doorsteps. In some cases, you find instances where these men went missing and investigators didn't even realize they were gay for months after their disappearance, despite the overwhelming evidence, you know, that was the case. You saw instances where repeatedly, even though there was an LGBTQ liaison inside the Toronto Police Service, they were not called or engaged with whatsoever. So it's, you know, I think people are looking for that smoking gun to say, you know, that there was one cop or one manager who was outwardly homophobic. But the reality is the problem is far more pernicious and deep-rooted than that. Again and again and again, officers in the Toronto Police Service failed to fully follow the leads that could have brought them to solving this case earlier. You know, they failed to ask the right questions. They failed to think more broadly about the community and how the community could help them solve this case, or how their status may have made them vulnerable. And, you know, it also goes to the broader question of how our police services operate. You know, the way in which they continue to criminalize sex workers, drug users, sometimes queer people. You know, we often forget, but the Toronto Police Service was issuing tickets and arresting gay men for hooking up at a park, even as men were going missing. So, you know, this is why I say, and this is why the report says, there's an issue of underservice but over-policing. There was lots of resources, apparently, to arrest and harass queer people, sex workers, trans people, but apparently there just wasn't the resources and the staffing there to adequately investigate these missing persons cases. And, you know, that reality is one that the Toronto Police Service is going to have to rectify.
Justin Ling, freelance investigative journalist, author of Missing from the Village, about the Bruce MacArthur serial killings. And we're talking about this just released massive report from the Ontario Court of Appeal judge, retired Gloria Epstein, that talks about this. One of the questions is, if they didn't have these biases or blind spots, I mean, I know they interviewed Bruce MacArthur and he didn't even, you know, they kind of sort of lost interest until, I guess it was, as you write in your book, it was Andrew Kinsman, the last victim, his family really and friends kind of kicked up a storm. But apparently Judge Epstein saying, why did the investigators lose steam here? Why should it be up to the public to urge this investigation? That seems to suggest that maybe this guy could have been caught earlier.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I mean, there were so many situations and points across this timeline where MacArthur could have been identified as a suspect and arrested earlier. You know, like you note, he was interviewed in 2013 in connection with the initial three missing persons cases. He sat in that room and he lied to investigators. And actually, there's a really frustrating section of this report where Justice Epstein notes that if investigators had done a little bit of digging, a tiny bit of work to look through some of MacArthur's messages to one of the victims, they would have realized he was lying in the interrogation room about not having a sexual relationship with one of the victims. You know, I've spoken to friends of that victim who have said that they told officers that MacArthur had a sexual relationship with their friend. Yet MacArthur sat in that room and lied to them, and police didn't pick up on it. You know, there was an instance where one man disappeared in 2015 and was not connected back to the original three cases because police didn't do a good enough job of investigating his past and realizing he had ties to the gay village. There was an instance where MacArthur was arrested in 2016 for assaulting a man, where, you know, the investigators did not pick up on the fact that he had been tied to these three missing persons cases.
Yeah, there's so
many spots.
And this, listen, this report's just come out. Nobody better to go through this with than Justin Ling. I know you're going to be on News Talk 1010 and other stations talking more about this. This is more than a one-day story. Something's got to change. This is a landmark report. I'm speaking with Justin Ling, investigative reporter and author of Missing from the Village. Thank you. I really appreciate you doing the work on this, Justin, and joining us. We do have to take a break. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Helping you through these unique times. This is the Evan Solomon Show.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. Good to have you back. You know, I like to end the show not in a rage, not in a complaint, not with sadness, but with kind of like something happy, something we could all talk about. So this morning, my two kids who are on their April break because the March break was canceled and now they're in school is canceled for the next 2 weeks, they decided to use this time to get their driver's license. So they are now doing an online driver's ed. So I'm in the basement, they're upstairs doing their driver ed. So they've now both got their G1. They are driving, which is like remarkable to me, with my wife and I, or I in the car, or sometimes both. And they're good. They're good drivers. But I got to tell you, and I want your thoughts on this, your worst stories of driving with your kids or driving with your parents. If you're someone who's driving with your parents, call me at 1-855-633-1010. If you're right now listening to us and you've been driving, or you at one point had to drive with your mom or dad and they were nervous, I want to hear that story. What was it like driving with your parent? Or if you're a parent, what's the worst story about driving with your kid? 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. Like when I was learning driving, my dad would be in the car and I would be nervous, and I didn't realize that because I tried to play it cool. And I apparently I would whistle. He always used to call me the whistler, and I'd be like driving my, and he said, what are you whistling about there, whistler? I say, what do you mean? He goes, you've never whistled before. You know, you whistle when you're nervous, when you drive. I didn't know this. I'm 16 and I'm whistling. And then I realized when I'm nervous, I whistle. When I'm driving with my kids now, they're pretty cautious, but I've actually, at one point I have my hand sometimes on the gear shift. It's not stick. I grew up driving stick, right? Standard, but it's automatic. But you know, because at first I was nervous that maybe I can't put my foot on the brake, but I would shift it into neutral. They hate that. I once, when my daughter was driving, I've even grabbed the wheel and sort of, because I thought she was drifting into her car. She's actually a very good driver. But and they would prefer to drive with my wife, who's a little more cool under fire. But I'm trying to be cool. Like kids in cars, right? It's a nerve-wracking experience. My brother and I were not. I remember the first day I got my driver's license, the first day, I didn't even tell my dad. I backed into another car and dented the bumper, and I just took off. I was 16. I didn't hurt the other car, but I didn't say anything to my dad. My brother smashed up our station wagon once. This is the worst car story. My brother, when he was like 17, took our car, got into a car accident, drove home. My parents came home, but in the interim between the accident and my parents' arrival home from work, my brother got invited to a Neil Young concert by his friend and decided to go, leaving the following note to my father on the car. Dear Dad, it's not as bad as it looks. Gone to the Neil Young concert. Talk to you in the morning. How do you think that went over? That went over very poorly. You can never say it's not as bad as it looks. 1-855-633-1010 or 710. If you're listening and you're driving, Tom in London. What's up, Tom? Okay, Tom, you got to turn off your radio. Pablo in Mississauga, what's up?
I learned how to drive really early. Probably about 8 years old, I started racing go-karts. And then at about 12 or 13, my brother actually started teaching me in his Jeep. And the first thing he did was take me out to a parking lot in the middle of the winter, and we started doing donuts. And first thing he said to me was, you know, driving is a fun thing. Driving is an escape, and it's fun. There's a lot of danger involved, but it's fun. And once I learned that it was fun, and then he taught me the dangerous parts, and never looked back since. Now I'm a heavy haul truck driver. I haul the biggest stuff down the road, and it's still fun to me.
Oh, man, that's awesome. That's a great memory. Hey, Pablo, first of all, thanks for the work you did, especially in the pandemic, man. We've needed that. But, yeah, isn't that a good memory? Like, to me, driving with my parents, and like, I love driving. My wife and I, a road trip is like one of our all-time favorite things. Get the radio on. As soon as we get in the car and we have a road trip, it's fantastic. Pablo, thanks, brother. I love that. Donuts in the parking lot with your dad. Karen, what's up? Yeah.
Hey, Evan. I have a son who's physically handicapped. He had to learn to drive with hand controls. And as he was getting to the point where he was going to be able to drive independently, we realized we'd never taught him to put gas in the car. So my husband, myself, his older brother were all in the car with him, and we were, you know, we stopped at the Flying J, and it was a cool day. So my husband said, oh, here, I'll just coach you how to do this through the window. So my son, my handicapped son got out, and my husband is saying, okay, take the card, put it in this way. No, okay, press that button. No, oh, take the card out now. And as he's coaching him, his brother is yelling out from the back seat, put in 5 cents, put in 5 cents, put in 25 cents. And I'm saying, Ian, be quiet, you know. And so it's looking a little bit chaotic. And after a few minutes of that, we looked up, and we were at a Flying J, and there's like four or five other people, and they're just, everyone stopped and staring at us.
That.
And we're like, they're going to call the police on us. You know, it looks like we're abusing a handicapped person.
Oh, my God, that is good. But good for you, man. That's great. Does he drive now, your son?
Accident. Oh. He's now 36 years old, and he is a really good driver.
Nice. Well, listen, yeah. Great call. I love that, Karen in Montreal. Man, I got so many texts. Evan, my daughter is the scariest type of teenage driver. She thinks she's the best driver on the road. I refuse to drive with her. She's also the most stubborn of my children. I'm scared to death. Give her a license. Evan, my mom would put her foot through the floor, quote, braking for me. My dad would knock the stick shift into neutral with his knee as well and laugh his head off. I do that too. My wife to this day, she brakes suddenly, if she's driving and I'm in the passenger, she'll put her arm out like my mom used to do, like as if she's going to stop me from going through the windshield. I'm like, thanks, honey. That's not. Evan, my poor daughter, her first time driving with both her dad and I in the car, she had her G1. She got nervous with her dad, panicked, drove through the stop sign and ended up on the front lawn of our neighbor's lawn. Oh, that's good. Evan, my mom put pillows around her legs and only let me go back and forth between two driveways on a little used dirt road. Ah, driving with your kids. Evan, 50 years ago, six kids in the back, my dad steering with his knee, rolling a cigarette with my mom, telling him he's driving too fast. Oh, yeah, I remember that. The worst driving trick, I think my mom and dad are listening. My dad had bought a new car. And he said to my mom, Virginia, this is great. There's a new system on the car. This is like 25 years ago. All you have to do to stop it is pull the steering wheel back. And he showed her, she's in the passenger seat, but he was pressing the brake with the other foot. And then she gets in the car. She goes out the next day and she comes home to dinner that night. She goes, Carl, are you trying to kill me? I was pulling that steering wheel back. It doesn't work. I almost rear-ended someone. He's like, I was kidding. You thought that was real? He told her that you could brake just by pulling the steer. Oh, my God. My mom almost got killed for my father. That is a funny driving story. Anyway, look, my kids are learning how to drive. I think they're going to be great. And guess who they'd rather learn with, me or my wife? My wife. Anyway, pay attention up there. It's online learning. Online learning. You know how that goes. Keep listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network. If you're listening to the radio, drive carefully. Catch me on Power Play tonight at 5 p.m. Eastern on CTV News Channel. Drive carefully. Have some laughs. Hug your loved ones. We'll chat again tomorrow.